Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room are Karen Boonquist and Bill Strelo speaking on engaging God, God's economy. So let's listen in on Karen and Bill.
Welcome to this third session between Karen Boonquist, Bill Strelo, and all of you, and the common conversation that we are in these 3 days is engaging God, terms of engagement. And this morning we're going to be spending some time talking about God's economy. And for those of you who have been here before, you'll remember that what we're talking about is engaging God, the God of the biblical record. And we're engaging God and looking on what that term of engagement might be within a culture of disbelief. And you recall that I've been using that culture of disbelief because it's a title by a fellow by the name of Stephen Carter, and that's the title of his book, The Culture of Disbelief, basically looking at the cultures of North America. And what we're going to be doing this morning is looking at this terms of engagement in and around God's economy. And Karen's put some words on the board. And as you look at those words, perhaps they strike you in one of two ways. They might strike you as religious words, saving, trust, redemption. But I ask you to transpose those words as those words also become economic words. Words that are pretty much part and parcel of the economy that we live in. Savings banks, saving fidelity, promissory notes, debt, redemption. We look for good futures. Confidence, and obviously we look, have some trust funds. So how easy it is to take what has been biblical language and see it as economic parlance that we are shaped by. So Karen's going to spend most of the time talking about some things, and then hopefully we'll have some time for some good discussion.
One of the reasons for putting those phrases up there is because I think the overall thing we want to get at today is the way in which religious language can readily become appropriated and at times compromised by some of the dominant systems and some of the dominant logics that we live with. So I want to begin just by saying some things about how a kind of logic of the market society, in other words, a logic that is informed by the market economy that we live with, how that has come to permeate so much of the thinking and action of our society. And I think that we in the church need to take account of that. You'll recall this series. We began by saying that theology in our day needs to be done by taking our context very seriously and to say, now, how do the deeply religious questions emerge in the midst of that context? So I want to just lay out a few things first that hopefully are recognizable to you in terms of how a logic of a market economy has come to be the predominant logic shaping us in this society. The emergence of the market society in many ways is seen as the great modern revolution. The modern age promised rational, scientific-based progress with a market economy with democratic freedom and an ever-present optimism that things will get better if only we let the laws of the economy carry on. And those laws, in a sense, then become a kind of God for which all kinds of sacrifices can be made. Sacrifice of relationships within the family at times, you know, in order to somehow earn that money that we need to support the family. People, processes, and values increasingly have come to be measured in economic terms. You know, what is the value of that relationship? Well, what's in it for me? You know, what's the bottom line? You know, rather than somehow that relationship or that activity having meaning in and of itself. In our day, codes of moral obligations are often shaped less by the church than they are by the market and by the state. An emphasis on technique has displaced an emphasis on moral obligation to people, as people who have inherent worth and value because they are God's creation. But that often has been displaced, as well as our sense of obligation to the earth or the kind of bonds that bind us together with the rest of other creatures. More and more of our social relationships are organized by rational decision makers who seek advantage over others. Risk and access to information is what matters, especially in our day where the economy is especially based not so much on who has capital, but who has knowledge, you know, who has the latest computer technology and telecommunications, and the fact that the economy is driven in our day by forces that are somewhat different from what they perhaps were even as recently as 10 or 20 years ago. Community ties of intimacy, reciprocity, and sympathy end up being sacrificed at times for the sake of market ties that are rational, temporary, and instrumental. And I think this is what many communities are discovering as they began to pull together and to say, hey, does the decisions that the businesses in this community make and that may be affecting our community in some negative ways, do we just kind of let that happen? Or do we begin to bring some other values into all of this? The nature of communities as well as of the family have been deeply affected by the way this kind of market logic has overtaken us. Boom towns and bust towns have been identified by social scientists as the places where distrust, alienation, and divorce, for example, are higher. People buy the right public school for their children by buying into the right neighborhood. And the marketplace and freedom of choice in many high schools are similar to the shopping malls where teens spend much of their free time. Consumption has become the predominant activity, giving focus to American family life. I can assure you, in addition, I'm including our own family in that. Stop and think how much of our time is spent absorbing messages about what we should purchase, earning the money to buy what we can't live without, shopping for it, purchasing it, and then having to go through the whole process again to get what we now need to go with it, and then getting frustrated with how all this complicates our lives even further, organizing what we have so that our lives don't get buried in the accumulation of what we have, and eventually somehow having to get rid of it. That kind of endless cycle that just seems to generate, you know, more and more that we have to do, and suddenly we feel captive to all of it. But seldom do we stop to ask, why has the consumption of goods and services become such a major focus of so many families' lives together? The logic of the market shapes and to a significant degree determines what our culture, what our society is about, including, I'm afraid, at times in the culture of the institutional church. a church's captivity to some of the same market logic becomes apparent when the institutional church becomes focused primarily on what will not offend but what will please the customers, giving people a religion that's palpable, doing whatever in order to increase the budget or increase the membership, to somehow measure the success of the church in these same kinds of terms of dollar signs and number signs. I say that because one of the things I don't want us to go away from this session of is saying, oh, well, somehow we as Christians, you know, can somehow rise above it. I think there's a very real sense, and I think this especially comes through in Lutheran theology, that we are in but not of the world. We live in that kind of tension of realizing that we can't be purist and say, hey, we're not caught in that too. You know, we can't just say, oh, well, we're going to somehow transcend and not have anything to do with the market economy. We're caught in it. It's a part of the given of our reality. But the question is, how can we as Christians find ourselves also at the same time defined by another reality, by, as it were, another logic of economy that can help us to stand in that critical kind of place where we raise critical questions in the midst of the ongoing logic of the market economy. And so that's what I want to get us into a bit more this morning. I'm going to be drawing heavily on some understandings that come out of this book by Douglas Meeks called God the Economist. It's a book that was published about 5 years ago. It's available in the Holden Library. In fact, that's the copy I have here. I'll return it there in case some of you want to look at it. It's a very complex kind of book, so I'm going to just try to present a few things in the short time we have. But underlying what Meeks is about in this book is an understanding that we as Christians are caught between two very different visions or ways of life. The market economy on the one hand, and what Meeks talks about as God's economy on the other. Now he uses that word, that phrase, God's economy, or as you can tell from the title, God the Economist, in some ways that may sound rather strange to our ears. And I think part of the reason that sounds so strange is that economy, economists, that sort of thing, that's acquired all kinds of connotations that we think of as, well, that's off here, you know, that, to use Lutheran categories, that's kind of left hand of the kingdom kind of stuff, and then here's what God, you know, here's the right hand of the kingdom and all that sort of thing. And so the words sound very foreign when we try to talk about economy in relationship to what God is all about. But that's the central thing that Meeks is trying to do in his book, that God is about a kind of economy. Many of you are probably familiar with the Greek word oikos, and it's the root kind of word from which ecumenical, household, various words are rooted in that Greek word. And Meeks does a lot of interesting building on that notion of how can we understand what God is about, or what the church historically has referred to as God's providence. How can we understand and talk about that as God's economy? God's concern for the whole household, the public household, the household of the whole world, not just our private household, the whole inhabited world, and what God is about in that world in an ongoing way. How this economy has to do with the very character as well as the very work of God. And to be a part of this household is to have, first and foremost, access to livelihood, access to what it is that makes life human, and therefore immediately this suggests some concern for how those resources that make life human are distributed, what it means to talk about sufficiency for all rather than economic laws that are based primarily on understandings of scarcity, which economists regularly use as a key understanding of what makes the economy go. Meek says, no, there's something quite different going if we put this together and think this through in terms of some biblical understandings of God's activity. And so what I think he calls us back to, what Meeks in his book calls us back to, is to really rethink and in a sense reappropriate some very key first article understandings of who God is, that stuff we learned in confirmation, and how God provides. It is God who provides for our needs, which are not synonymous with the wants, the endless wants that are generated by the market economy. And that whole sense of God's providence that unfortunately has increasingly faded as a kind of operative category that we think of when we think of our society today. We've often separated who we are as Christians from our lives as economic beings. And Meeks contends that when we do that, we are, in a sense, falling into the trap of denying what God's providence is all about. God's economy, he says, is found in God's life, work, and suffering for creation. We enter God's economic work through our baptism into the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the central law of God's economy, in other words, what is at the kind of crux of what God's way of ordering creation is all about, involves an ongoing struggle for life and against all those forces that would bring death. Not just physical death, but the death of human dignity as it occurs in some aspects of the economy, as well as the death resulting from lack of access to the resources that are needed for life to be human. God's economic work begins with those excluded, who have been excluded in one way or another from the public household, from the access to livelihood. Biblical God language is fundamentally economic, Meeks asserts. It has to do with matters such as work, property, consumption, distribution of resources. But as Bill was pointing out earlier, some of those good biblical words that were part of understanding what it is that God is about have been, in a sense, stolen away and used to talk about how the economic system operates. And the importance of having trust and faith almost becomes a commodity then to kind of keep the economic system going and, the banking and financial kinds of aspects that are a part of that. One of the interesting observations that we've discovered a few years ago, the ELCA ran a listening post survey of members. And in terms of lay members of the ELCA, even though there was a fairly significant percentage of people who said, yes, the church or Christians do need to be concerned about the poor, and we do need to be concerned about people who are unemployed. When they were asked whether the church should have anything to do with economic questions, a very low percentage felt that was appropriate or important for the church to be involved in. I say that because it's been one of those rather humbling statistics that we've had a look at when we've begun the very beginning stages of the process of developing a social statement on economic life. I will mention this at the end too, but there's a little announcement about that and a little survey form regarding that process that I'd invite you to take if you haven't seen it before you leave. So I think part of the challenge that we face in our society today as Christians is how can we help people see those connections, and that you know, the Bible may not have to say a lot to say about some of the other issues that we're facing today, including, quite frankly, the topic of sexuality, but it has an awful lot to do with economic questions, you know, about greed and wealth, and some survey has said it's really about the second most predominant topic brought up in Scripture. So we're not talking about something that is being imported into the biblical witness, but it's permeated with concern for God's economy, even though we often haven't thought of it in quite those terms. The laws of the market economy have become unquestioned ruling powers, a kind of providence under which we operate. Market forces are said to be automatic, unconscious, with unintended consequences. And in a sense, therefore, economic laws or economic understandings fulfill the public function that notions of God's providence fulfilled previously. This eclipse of God by the market has occurred especially since the 17th century. In other words, this has been a gradual development. It's not just something that's hitting us in the 1990s. And increasingly in a market economy, the accumulation of wealth has been at the expense of some, and some who then become invisible in the working of the market. People being cut off from having access to livelihood. And I think in our day, one of the things that is probably making us take that more seriously is we're not just dealing with those who have been unemployed and poor all their lives or for generation after generation, but we're dealing with lots of other folks who are now hit with the fact that their access to livelihood in a changing economy is being cut off also. So on the one hand, we live in a market economy that has to do especially with accumulation of wealth, with making profit, and with relationships of exchange, and that those foci often occur at in a way that overshadows what is the focus of God's economy, namely what it takes for life to be human for all. Finally, I want to just lay some things out, and we can talk about a number of these things. I want to then just say something about how concepts of God have changed with changes in the economic system. Where has divinity been lodged? And we've been saying throughout this series, how do we engage God? And then that means really critiquing the way in which God language and what has operationally become our God or our idol gets lodged somewhere other than our understanding of what the biblical God is up to. Certainly in pre-capitalist economies, and I would say in many arenas in our own day, God is seen as all-powerful, immortal, self-sufficient, the absolute ruler. And what becomes especially important in terms of our image of God is an understanding of there being a kind of centralized power and authority. God is seen, as it were, as the absolute owner of all that is, the owner of the world, and the one who owns rules. Now, part of the difficulty is those understandings of God then were used to legitimize or to reinforce certain patterns in society of rulership. Under feudalism or under monarchy, various configurations of absolute economic and political power. Now, under a market economy, some of those same kinds of attributes, Meek suggests, become associated with how human beings as economic actors are viewed. He suggests that what has happened is that, you know, God has kind of faded a bit from the picture. But what has happened instead is we talk about unlimited profit-making or accumulation or unlimited consumption, individual sovereignty, the kind of possessive individualism that we were making reference to yesterday, and really the individual and the individual economic actor becomes, as it were, sovereign, with unlimited power to acquire and to sell property. And therefore, human beings become the owners, you know, those who have kind of absolute right to private property to own the world. And those who own are free to rule. One of the interesting experiences I had last month was being in Mexico for a short time, and a lot of flurry around there in preparation for the elections. And even though there's been, a real upsurge in democratic participation in Mexico that was really coming to expression in lots of ways, still lots and lots of suspicion because of the ways in which large-scale economic interests in Mexico have made, you know, huge contributions to the ruling party. I haven't even heard the election results. Did they? They win. And so even though there have been some positive economic changes, certainly the 40% who are the poor of Mexico, very, very suspicious of all of that. And certainly very suspicious of the way in which, even though there's all kinds of rhetoric about more democratic participation, it was clear that the political realities were very much controlled by the economic interests. Obviously, Mexico isn't the only place where that occurs, but it was particularly glaring while we were there. And therefore, the fact that Mexico now has a rather significant number of the richest people in the world, and that those people are very much controlling a lot of the political developments there, was a source of great dismay to many who were really working for much more democratic participation in the society. So I think there's some dangerous ways in which this kind of unlimited right to, you know, economic accumulation and development can become almost a kind of substitute for how we understand God's providence. God, therefore, can become merely the condition of human freedom rather than a God who is somehow centrally involved in creation and in the ongoing activity that tries to keep life human for all. So in the midst of a global market economy, which I think is the pervasive reality that we live with today, as we're trying to do some initial thinking about this statement, that I think is the one thing that the task force that has met once says that's what's so different from what might have been the case 15, 20 years ago. We can't ignore that reality. We can't ignore the fact that how we understand capital and labor and all the other factors of an economy are quite different because of the fact that the national boundaries don't make much difference in terms of the global movement of capital. In the midst of a global market economy, how can we as Christians think about and make a case for God as the faithful promiser, the one who continues to stand and to speak, all having access to livelihood? how can we remind ourselves and others that God is not simply a self-sufficient, autonomous individual, in other words, the kind of possessive, individualistic, writ large, but God as a Trinity, a community of persons. And how can we assert, as Meek suggests, quote, a logic of God's economy that creates access to livelihood by the gifting of God's righteousness, which is God's power for life, unquote. In other words, finding those critical spaces in our society where we say, hey, no, human beings and all that human beings do and produce is not defined and measured primarily by marketability, by the exchange value. God's freedom is constituted not by God's exclusive property owning, but God's freedom is the realization and expression of God's love, a self-giving love seen in Jesus Christ, and a God who is passionately engaged with what is going on in terms of the economy. God is passionately engaged, particularly in terms of identifying with the plight of those who continually find themselves on the short end of the economy, and how, therefore, can we be those who are attuned to what it is that God's intentions and God's providence is about in the midst of the ongoing economic discussions of our day. Clearly, I'm not so naive as to say, well, somehow now, you know, the whole society is going to get organized by God's economy. The reality of sin, the fact that we live in the already but not yet, it isn't a matter of somehow that kingdom is going to be brought on earth, but at the same time, there's a necessary tension there that I think we as Christians can too readily give up on and say, oh, well, that's the way it goes, and kind of cynically say, you know, we can't do anything about it, so we'll kind of retreat into a kind of privatized faith understanding that cuts off those public dimensions about what God's providence is all about. I'm going to finish my part of this by just reading a very brief portion where I think from Meek's book, where he juxtaposes these two kinds of understandings that I've been dealing with this morning. The God who justifies scarcity and the apathetic elimination of all suffering must be a God incapable of suffering. The God known in Jesus and Israel, on the contrary, is not impassible, but rather suffers and identifies with those who suffer. The God who justifies rights to exclude others from livelihood must be a self-sufficient monad one who possesses oneself and doesn't have anything to do with others. The God known in Jesus and Israel, on the contrary, is not a radical individual of pure choice, but is a community constituted by relationships of persons with peculiar characteristics and tasks. Each is constituted by his or her reciprocal relationships to the others. There is no domination of others and no principle of hierarchy. Each has distinctive identity and work, but except for these, they have all things in common. The God who justifies the separation of the worker and his or her product must be one who coerces the labor of a slave, in distinction, for example, from the God that we know through the Exodus. The work of the God known in Jesus and Israel, on the contrary, does not coerce the other in an ends-means relationship, but is the free gifting of God, which serves life and invites the free response of the other for the sake of the life of the community. God is not an individual maximizer.
As I look around the room today and remember looking at folks that were here the last few days, I might be bold enough to say that with one or two exceptions, most of us have been around the block of life more than once. I'm 52, and I can recall a few days after turning 50, which wasn't a difficult chore in retrospect, I received my application for ARP membership, and that was a cultural bump, to which my son is still trying to figure out, well, why was he so upset? But I say that as a way of inviting us into some conversation, as we've been around the block of life and around the block with Jesus more than once, and there's some wear and tear on the treads of our mobility. I want you to think with me about your experience within the church. Going as far back as you can in your memory, and to think of those times when within the conversations around your cohorts of the faith, that you talked about things of an economic nature, where you talked about the American economy, or just the economy of the world, or where you talked about anything, excuse me, that might be related to that. Will you do that with me? In a Bible class or whatever.
In the women's study, there, for a total of 2 or 3 years, it seemed the theme continually was the poor amongst us and what we're going to do about it, until finally the women kind of said, if I hear about it one more time. I think it's generally a feeling that what can we really truly do about it anyway.
Okay, so when did that Bible study occur?
That was probably a kind of a series about 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
The last couple
okay.
of years.
Was that one of the first times that you can remember within a Bible study talking about something that had to do?
So consistently.
Okay. How about anyone else here? Can you remember anything like that going on within your Christian upbringing? Well, I can't. You know, I cannot remember at all being raised a good Lutheran in Chicago, ever having any conversation about economy, as Karen has presented to us today. And I say that because about 3 years or maybe 4 years ago, I went with a group of folks from Augsburg College, where they have the Center for Global Education, where they take people like myself and people like you who have lived all our lives within a North American context and not been taught to be too critical of that. Well, we went to Latin America, and the thing that I remember most occurred on the last day, where we met with the president of the University of Nicaragua, as well as some people who he had gathered with him. And they said the three things that we talk about, the three things that we talk about and teach our children to talk about in Nicaragua are this: Christianity, nationalism, and economics. Christianity, their faith, their shaping as a people of God,
nationalism because of all the things that had been going on in Nicaragua and still go on in Nicaragua, the tremendous nationalism that exists in that country and indeed many Latin American countries and probably all countries, and economics, that one cannot talk about the other without talking about the second or the third. And it just dawned on me as he said that, wouldn't it be interesting if we could find a way of doing that within a North American context, to talk about how we are Christian and how we are tremendous patriots, and at the same time, as Karen said, the codification, our obligations, are not so much shaped publicly by God as they are shaped by the economic structures that we live in. And what might we do when the women of the church, and I think it's worthy to note that the women of the church brought forth this Bible study, when all of a sudden we are exposed to the plight of the poor, and what might we do about that? And what is our limits that we can do about that? And how can we glean and ferret from the biblical story some of this economy that is of God, God's way of managing the household? The other thing that I want us to touch on for a few moments is to go back to a question that was raised here, I believe, yesterday. I don't think the gentleman's here. But what might we do as Christians in North America to engage God as we disengage from this culture of disbelief? And I think the important thing that the gentleman said when he raised the question was the pronoun we. It's not what I can do, but what might we do? And that, I think, is linked with that discussion I had with that president of the university in Nicaragua. And what might we do is that if we can move the conversation from the singular personal pronoun, I, to we, I think that's the first step that we can make. I think the second step is that we need to read the Bible together. Remember what we said a couple of days ago, that this is ethicist in Duke, Stanley Hauerwas, who's writing a lot of books these days, where he's making a suggestion, and at first hearing it's rather bizarre and shocking, that he doesn't want anybody to read the Bible individually.
It's dangerous to do that.
It's dangerous to do that. Rather, he's proposing that we return to reading the Bible, or we renew our reading of the Bible as a group of people, the we that gentleman was talking about, so that we have some check and balances as we read it, and we don't go off into individual interpretations that might not be as accurate to what the text is wanting to say. What he's suggesting, I say, is what Karen has been alluding to, and what we've been alluding to all these days, that if in fact the economic structure that we live by has put God on the edge of society, and you know, many economics will say that we do not have any control, that the market is free to go and pursue its own interests, and that we don't need any guiding principles. If God is removed from the logic or the way of doing things, and God is placed on the edge of our economy or the edge of our lives, then we might make the mistake of looking at Scripture in ways that is damaging to health. And that's what Hauerwas is saying. How can we read Scripture in such a way that it informs us to be God's people who are in but not of the world?
If I can just jump in, I think an example of what you're saying there is the way in which I think certain portions of Scripture have regularly been read to say, well, you know, God will bless me if only I work hard enough. In other words, if I'm, you know, an effective economic actor, you know, I will be blessed. And, you know, various ways in which, you know, the kind of understandings and the kind of logic of our economy gets read into what's going on in terms of the scriptural witness.
And then picking up again on this fellow's question, how might we engage this God that Jesus points to? This God that Jesus constantly reveals to a culture that in so many ways had done what we're doing, put God on the edge of life. And you recall that we've been urging you to look at a book by Marcus Borg called Jesus, A New Vision, where he talks about what Jesus was about was pointing to this God, revealing this God as a God of compassion within a society that had organized itself around pity, mercy, and exclusion. And Borg writes that book to say, what are the driving energies around which our economy has been organized? He'll say, it's not compassion. That's God's economy. That's God's way of managing the household. What he might be saying is the way we have organized ourselves is how we achieve something in this world. And how we make our own identity in this world. Those are the driving energies. And what he wants to suggest, and how might the church, the faithful people of God, talk about what the energies are that we find ourselves organized around. And then basically he's saying there's four ways of being this new visionary people. We can either withdraw completely from society. He says that makes very little sense. Or we can say that we'll continue to legitimize what the status quo is. Or we can separate ourselves and isolate ourselves. Or we can be a transformative people within a community. A community that does some of the hard thinking that folks in Nicaragua were telling me about. That if you're going to be a Christian, that's fine. But you need to talk about your own patriotism. And you need to talk about the economics that shape your life. And I think the other thing that I would suggest that we can do as we engage this God is to look at what's being done by a lot of biblical scholars today in terms of the historical Jesus. You hear a lot of press about that. But I would say pay attention to that because it's inviting more and more people into the discussion about who Jesus is and what Jesus has been doing. And as you look at this historical Jesus, begin to look at some of the biblical texts anew, particularly books that are coming out on the parables of Jesus. And looking again at how much time Jesus spends talking with his disciples and talking with the great crowds that follow him about matters of economy, about managers and laborers. So let's go back to you. What in your upbringing, or of what earthly good might it be to begin to think about God and the economy in the same breath?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, and when you're talking about the four things, four possibilities, what we can do, it sounds very much like there's a book called The Politics of Jesus by John Howard Wilder. And he says those same things in there, our choices. But also within that book, in calling Jesus very much a political and economic person, points to the text from Isaiah about as Jesus' opening platform for his politics, as proclaiming the year of the Lord's favor. And the year of the Lord's favor pointing back to, is it Leviticus, Deuteronomy text, the idea of sabbatical and jubilee, where debt is forgiven, where land is given a rest, where land is returned to original owners. Turning economics as we know it just topsy-turvy, that you give it back and you start all over again. Just thought I'd.
It was very interesting. About 6 years ago, I was involved in a meeting that occurred in Berlin that was dealing with the global debt at that time, and a number of speakers there. The World Bank and IMF were represented there too, and it was a rather interesting dynamic in terms of what some of the theologians, particularly from third world countries with large debt, this was in the mid-80s, but drawing on that very passage, you know, how does the debt kind of thing get to you? What does it mean to pray that in the Lord's Prayer?
Without that sense of jubilee or sabbatical, I mean, the debt of the poor nations is so oppressive that they'll, without that forgiveness of debt, they simply will never escape their poverty.
In addition to the inviting of some responsive bills given, I don't know if any of you are more involved in the for-profit economy than, you know, than those of us who, you know, are employed by the church. Maybe I would appreciate some of your perspectives, because I'm aware that some of this can sound very naive and platitudinous, and that's not where we wanted to end up. You know, in other words, I think that the key thing is for some dialogue that says, well, yeah, these are the realities of how the market operates. Well, maybe we do need to critique that, but not in a way that's totally naive either. So I'd invite some response that may say, well, hey, wait a minute now, I don't agree with that. Or just whatever responses, whatever.
I think of one of the financial planners in a congregation I serve, and someone was talking, you know, about investing some money, about the social ramifications of what corporations he was investing in. And he said, if you want to play games, you play games. If you want to invest money, you invest money. You don't ask those kind of questions. Mm-hmm. He basically said, this is a leader in the church. Mm-hmm. And he just cuts that part of it. That's not a part of his life. He lets God speak to him and say, I'm into making money for my clients. Mm-hmm. And if you want social responsible funds, I'm not the person for it. He's vice president of lunch.
End of conversation.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much as far as he's concerned. Mm-hmm.
So is he saying then that he will live with the, if Meeks has got anything to say here, God removed from the logic of the economy?
I would say so. Yeah. The Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. has these three workshops that do on power, sex, and money. And I went to the one on money, and one of the things one of the leaders said was, you know, it used to be that you couldn't talk about sex, but now it's that you can't talk about money. And the people who have it are real anxious about losing it, and they want to be secretive. And those who don't have it are jealous and want it. And he said, it seems to me that Christ frees us from bondage to mind. But there's as much bondage in the church as there is in the world. In his experience, as they do these workshops around the country. But it was powerful, powerful stuff. Just wonderful.
That certainly says what doesn't bode well for the new study that the ELCA might be getting into, you know. If sexuality got people shook up, then what
is this, bring this up.
Economic study going to do? But again, I think it will get folks talking about the necessary things that heretofore might have been avoided. And I wonder why all these years in my Sunday school this was never brought up. And I cannot give any reasonable answer.
So don't you think today's economy is causing us to be skeptical for one thing? At the same time, we are losing the trust in God to a point.
I could say more about that?
Yes, I could.
Will you? All right. Fix my grammar. Will you?
The economy in such a way that God is in the back seat. How can we get him back up in front?
You know, I was going, one of the things I didn't bring in, and there's certainly lots of biblical passages that one could get in. One of the reasons this one is familiar to me is a week and a half ago I was part of the gathering of ELCA teaching theologians, and that gathering looked intensely at the book of Hosea, which is a very complex, disturbing kind of book. But one of the images running through there, particularly in the second chapter, is some very graphic language that talks about Israel's idolatry in terms of its worship of Baal, and therefore Israel having become like a prostitute. And actually, I think at one point Meeks even picks up on this particular passage and suggests that, you know, there's extraordinarily vivid biblical language. I mean, lots of the language about judgment and all that sort of thing. But in Hosea, Israel becoming like a prostitute, and how one can apply that today, when human relationships are reduced to their exchange value, or human beings to commodities. And, you know, and what was occurring there is, you know, Israel, you know, through complicity, kind of falling into worship of Baal. And, you know, well, yeah, the rains bring the harvest, and, the, you know, somehow that's how we get what we need. You know, it is through the economy. It's by following those laws, by doing what we need, by making the sacrifices, etc., that we get what we need, you know, and that's where we fall into the trap of, you know, well, maybe if it's only the bread alone, it's death by bread alone. You know, what about, as you very appropriately said, you know, the way in which God gets put in the back seat in terms of what really becomes the determiner of what life is all about.
Yeah, and to piggyback on what you said or draw upon it, like moving God from the back to the front seat, that's the risky business. Mm-hmm. That any time the church, to take Paul's admonition to be in but not of the world, begins to live out its life and the ethics that God might suggest, that's risky business, because we're asking not God only to be in the front seat, but God to be in the public square. And we've seen in America what happens when various religious visions are starting to be put into public square. Is that, you know, our political climate is full of anxiety. What might that mean? Whether it be from the, quote, Christian right or the Christian left or whatever. But the discussion, at least, is becoming more and more public. So it's a risky business to an economy, I'd say, that is driven to keep God on the edges, and as we've said before, to keep God solely in the interior of one's life. Which is anything but the biblical portrait that you and I have inherited.